Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly recap of local news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, Mia Love's campaign sues to try to stop the counting of ballots in Salt Lake County, while the margin in the 4th District race tightens even more. Also, the more than 71 people who died in Utah jails over the past 5 years. And later in the show, Salt Lake City jockeys to host another Winter Olympics. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor Dan Harry. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
Legal affairs reporter Jessica Miller. Hi, Jessica. Welcome.
Hello.
And columnist Holly Richardson is with us. Holly, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You are invited to join this discussion with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or posting them at sltrib.com. On this week's Behind the Headlines page that is currently live. Dan Harry, when will the election officially come to an end?
Never. They've decided they're just not going to end it.
We're all on pins and needles waiting for a couple of outcomes. Probably the most awaited result is the 4th District race. At this exact moment, Ben McAdams holds a razor-thin lead, but more and more things are kind of looking up for Mia Love, right?
Yeah, the margin from election night has narrowed considerably. So Ben McAdams now leads by 1,002 votes as of the latest count.
1,000.
So we'll get some more votes from Utah County today. We expect that to narrow. And, you know, there's a chance that Mia Love goes ahead in this count that is released today. They still won't have all the ballots counted. We won't know the final result until the canvass on Tuesday.
A number of political observers, pollsters, statisticians, and Robert Gerke have said that that Ben McAdams needed to win a bigger percentage of the votes released, this week than he got. 538. This is Nate Silver's political blog, weighed in on this, and they said that the race is now leaning in Love's direction.
Right, and that's changed three times in the last 3 days. So went from lean Democrat to toss-up to lean Republican. The problem with this, as we saw in the 2016 election, it's really hard to predict votes before they're counted. And one of the unknowns in this is the provisional ballots. So who are people who are voting provisionally? They're people who have moved here from somewhere else, people who haven't voted before. And so, you know, there are theories that these people would be primarily young people. Do they skew Democrat? Do they skew Republican? So there's a lot of unknowns. And I will not make any predictions, so don't ask.
Okay, well, we'll not do it. This is sort of made all the more interesting by the fact that the Love campaign is trying to stop the counting of ballots, or was suing to stop the counting of ballots in Salt Lake County, a legal maneuver. What's happening on that front?
Well, is it a legal maneuver or a political maneuver? I'm not sure, and I'm not sure I understand the strategy. Given the fact that the lead of McAdams was narrowing in Salt Lake County, I don't know that this makes a lot of sense. If he was increasing that margin every time Salt Lake County counted ballots, I would understand it. You know, they want to stop the counting because that hurts her. But the way it's going now, I'm not quite sure I understand it.
Holly Richardson, columnist and we should say former Republican state representative and political observer yourself, this is a strategy by the Love campaign, challenging the way ballots are counted, specifically in Salt Lake County. It's interesting because actually last week on the show we talked about Utah County, the governor called it being the epicenter of dysfunction, but she is focusing specifically on Salt Lake City's count. What do you think of this strategy?
Well, I don't have any inside information, but Sherry Swenson is a Democrat and Mia Love's a Republican. So I think that would be why it's county specific, right, and not going after the incompetence in Utah County. But I think to your point, Dan, about the ballots coming in from Utah County, traditionally she's going to do very, very well there. And she has this cycle also, right, when each time the vote count comes out from Utah County, she holds a very, very strong lead. And I don't expect that will change with the latest ballot counts. And so my only speculation is that in Salt Lake County with looking at provisional ballots. Were the procedures followed properly, right? Were they actually getting some sort of ID from the people who were voting provisionally as they are supposed to do by law? And the Love campaign assertion is that they were not doing that. And so I think they want to be able to challenge people who voted without providing proper identification.
Dan, is this, my microphone's not working. There we go. Is this about provisional ballots? Signatures have to do with this as well, matching signatures?
Signatures from mail-in. If you remember when you mailed in your ballot, you had to sign that. And they compare that with the signature that's on file with your registration. But provisional ballots and mail-in ballots are involved in this court action. So, you know, it is curious, though. The judge's questions yesterday seemed to be quite skeptical about this lawsuit. And the fact that he made no ruling,
right,
given the argument that this is an urgent matter, you know, we need a ruling now because these ballots are being counted and soon they'll all be counted, I don't think that it looks good in the court for the Love campaign.
As of right now, though, that ruling, there has been no ruling
right.
in this.
Which is a decision. By making no decision, the judge is making a decision
that
ballots will continue to be counted.
Is the McAdams, I mean, this is just interesting. We talked about, again, Utah County, but is the McAdams campaign doing anything similar in Utah County, for example, suing to stop the counting
no.
there? Okay. Well, we're getting more tallies today, as you said, and we're expecting a sizable drop from Utah County today.
Yes.
Is it the rest of Utah County's votes? Or?
There will be some ballots left. I am assuming most of those will be provisional ballots that haven't been counted. But I think most of the mail-in ballots will be included in today's tally.
You said Tuesday was the canvass. Does that mean that the election is over and done with on Tuesday?
So the way it works in a multi-county congressional district like this, the counties each certify their canvass, and then the state has to certify that canvass. And I think that's a ways off. I think the 26th, if I'm correct.
Holly pointed out just before we came on air that, you know, Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams has been in Washington, D.C. doing freshman orientation for new members of Congress. He was doing that as sort of a just-in-case kind of measure. I mean, he had to get the orientation if he was going to be.
I think they urged folks in races that are too close to call the possible freshmen to come just to be able to get that orientation done.
Don't spend too much money on the drapes yet, though.
Yeah, right.
You know, I know that some people are really enjoying the whole political drama. I got to tell you that I'm ready for some finality. Holly, are you relishing this? Done with it?
I do actually kind of enjoy it. So I'm sure for the people who are really close to it, the people whose jobs are depending on the outcome of this election, I'm sure that they don't enjoy it nearly as much as I do. But I think it has been interesting. I think the timing's been interesting. I think the change with timing and the vote by mail, right, the longer process, I think that's been interesting. And then there's always the potential of a recount, so maybe it won't be over on Tuesday.
Jessica Miller, I know this isn't exactly your beat, but you know, are you following this and wondering if it's ever going to end yourself?
Well, this actually was my first year that I covered election night. I've never done it before,
wow.
And so I've been kind of surprised that I've been part of the process. Now I'm like, oh my gosh, we're still doing this? Like, I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm just like, this is still happening. Okay,
still
we're doing
going.
It.
Well, speaking of not having finality, Proposition 4, Dan, this is the one that has gone back and forth. It's the ballot initiative to create an independent redistricting commission. What's happening with it, and when will it, you know, be over and make it all stop, Dan, right now?
So it picked up a little steam yesterday. It got some votes from Salt Lake County. So it's ahead, but it's very narrow. It's less than half a point.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll see what happens with Utah County. Those votes have generally gone against Prop 4, so it's a very close call. We had an interesting comment, too, from Senator Okerlund the other day, who has been one of the vocal opponents of this. And he said, well, it doesn't matter if it passes or not, because the margin's so close, it can't be read as a mandate of the people. So the legislature can just ignore this.
That's interesting. I mean, isn't the proposition passes if it has a simple majority, but lawmakers can read more into that maybe I'll ask Holly Richardson about this. You're a former Republican lawmaker. But what do you think about the proposition to, you know, create this independent redistricting commission in general, and then also the concept of a mandate depending upon the size of the vote?
Well, I don't think you can claim mandate. I mean, I do agree with Senator Oakland on that. I think you can say that opinions are divided. I mean, that's clear. As somebody who was in the legislature the last time we did redistricting, I would point out that all House and Senate seats for the state legislature were unanimously voted on. There was no opposition at all. The only ones that came into kind of a party line split were the congressional districts. So I personally was against this proposition for a couple of reasons. And one of them is I think that having a smaller number of people weighing in on the process doesn't make it less biased. I don't think it's going to be less problematic or less biased. And
well, what about the fact that the legislature is as largely you know, of one party as it is?
Yeah, I understand that. And at the same time, I think that there has been a considerable effort made to get the public involved in, like last time in the decision making. But last time there were, this was new, but we had online software where people could go in and draw a map, right? And Speaker Lockhart was the speaker at the time, and I remember her saying, it's really easy to draw one perfect district. The hard part is drawing 75 House districts, right, or 29 Senate districts. Because you can say, okay, well, I really like this, right, and I want to make sure that I don't divide this city or I don't divide this neighborhood. But when you're trying to fit all the pieces of the puzzle in, it's actually a lot harder than I think people realize.
How political is that process? Is it divorced from politics?
No. And I don't think it would be with a commission either. So there is political. I think that's clear. But there's also just practicality. So the area where I live, for example, it mostly includes my city of Pleasant Grove. That's about the size of a House district. But we have one end of the city where we have roads. I don't know why they did this, but we have roads that interlace like fingers between Cedar Hills and Pleasant Grove. And so at some point, they just had to draw a straight line and say, okay, north of this line, you're District 27. South of this line, you're District 57, even though some of it is Cedar Hills and some is Pleasant Grove. So, I mean, there's just stuff like that all the time. I think Spanish Fork has 3 state senators in it. It's a small town, but they had to split somewhere. And so Spanish Fork is where they ended up splitting.
Dan Harry, you know, we're waiting to see whether or not this passes. Again, it sounds like the legislature will I mean, according to Oakland at least, will tackle it and do something to it whether or not it passes, which is something that we're seeing also happening with Proposition 2, the medical marijuana ballot initiative. I mean, we've talked about this before, but ballot initiatives and what they mean at the end of the day.
Yeah. I think what Oakerlund was saying, that they weren't going to repeal the proposition if it passed. He was saying that the way the legislation is written, this is a recommendation.
Right.
The legislature doesn't have to approve it, but it can't amend it. So it can reject it and come up with its own plan, and I think that's what he was suggesting. As far as redistricting, I've covered 3 now, I think. They're a very political process. And I think the biggest argument for some independent body to do it is if you look at the congressional districts. You know, Salt Lake County for generations had a congressional district that mostly was in Salt Lake County. And that's changed over the last 2 redistricting cycles as Republicans have deliberately sought to basically disenfranchise Salt Lake City and other Democratic areas. We now have no congressional member that lives in Salt Lake City or in Salt Lake County. It's the most populous county. Those things on their face seem to point to a problem with politics interfering with good districts.
Well, even Salt Lake County, I mean, so I understand what you're saying, and there was discussion about whether you have a donut hole or you have this 4-way split that includes some rural as well as urban. But in Salt Lake County, you can't have just Salt Lake County be one congressional district. It's too big.
No, but you can have a district that is that is solely based within Salt Lake County. And communities of interest is what you're supposed to be looking at. Salt Lake City, many Salt Lake City residents do not like their representative. They oppose his policies very strongly, but because of the way that district is drawn, there's nothing they can do about it.
But will the Independent Redistricting Commission, as you said, it's going to be just recommendations to the legislature? Not that that's a reason not to do it, but is it going to solve the problem?
The idea is that you have this independent body. This is the theory, anyway. You have this independent body that does it without politics in mind, and that they make logical sense. And then if the public sees those and says, yes, that's very logical, you know, that helps me have somebody that represents my community, then there would be some public pressure on the legislature. I don't know if that theory would work, but that's the operating.
We have to go to a break here momentarily, but will it be a more public process than currently exists? And then maybe that's a question for Holly. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I would say I don't think it would be any more or less public than the process of the legislature. I mean, I think the legislature would do it in a public way. But I just don't think that you can get as independent as people would like to think, right? Because you're going to get appointees, and they're political appointees, right? Okay. So you like to call them independent, but they won't be independent.
Is there any way that, you know, AI could play into this, where you had polling of individuals and then districts were created around something to do? I mean, who knows? Maybe this is a company.
Maybe that's how you get the
Elon Musk. You get a computer to do it. I don't know.
Dan, any other big election news since our conversation last week, or can we leave elections behind and at least until Tuesday?
You know, I thought one of the interesting things that happened in the election was the approval of a constitutional amendment that allows the legislature to call itself into special session.
I was shocked at that. Actually, why are you giving the legislature more power?
The most reasonable theory I have heard is that people read it on the ballot because they didn't know a lot about it.
Yeah.
And that was their information, and it said the legislature would only do this in the case of emergency. Now, what they didn't know is that the legislature gets to define what an emergency is.
Right.
And if they want to come into special session, they will.
Okay. Thursday is Thanksgiving. The election canvass is Tuesday. Maybe we will all be giving thanks on the holiday.
That
it's over. Exactly. I don't know. Let's head to our first break of the show. When we come back, a spotlight on deaths in Utah jails and the story of a Utah woman who reported being sexually assaulted and who was then charged with a crime. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jessica Miller, government and politics editor Dan Harry, and columnist Holly Richardson. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or posting them at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com. Jessica Miller, let's turn now to reporting that you did this week on the number of deaths that have occurred in Utah jails in recent years. State lawmakers took a look at the data on this this week, and in addition to the numbers themselves, something else that's noteworthy is when these deaths occurred in relation to a person's incarceration, that is. Tell us about this data, Jessica. What does it point to?
So this is data that shows all the counties reported to the state this year of how many jail deaths they've had. This is any in-custody death, whether they died at the jail or if they were being transported like to a hospital, those deaths are counted as well. So in the last 5 years, there's been 71 deaths in Utah jails. About half of those were suicides. And about half as well were within like the first week of someone being booked into jail.
Why was this data gathered and given to lawmakers? I mean, it's because we saw a spike in prison deaths, and they're hoping to do something about it.
Exactly. Yeah. Last year, they passed a bill that basically. So before this, there really wasn't a state report that says this is how many deaths we have. It was county by county. They were keeping their numbers. They do have to report that to the feds, but as far as like defining what's a jail death, if they die at a hospital, is that considered a jail death? Like they could kind of decide, define for themselves what that was, and there wasn't a state report that kind of put that all together. So after a spike in jail deaths recently, lawmakers last year decided to make the counties report this information so we can kind of see what's happening and how can we change things to prevent these deaths from happening.
You pointed to suicide being a big cause, half of the deaths, if you look at statewide data. But if you looked at individual jails, what a person died from could vary quite a bit. I mean, you looked at a jail where suicide wasn't the leading cause, for example. I mean, this is, I think, in an article that I read.
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, the interesting thing about this data that, or the report that was made, was it didn't break down the information county by county, which I thought was kind of interesting, because it would be good to know, like, if in some jails, you know, in Weber County, for instance, if it's a suicide that most often is happening, or, you know, if in certain places it's drug overdoses. But as part of the report, they did have to say, like, what their policies were for dealing with people who are withdrawing from drug addictions, which is a lot of people who are going into the jail. And that was really interesting, because you had places like Salt Lake and Weber who have policies that say, you know, we can give you methadone, we can give you narcotic medication to help you come off or deal with those withdrawals. And you had like a place, I think it was Uinta County, that specifically said, we don't believe that treating addictions with narcotics is actually like a medical treatment, and so we won't give that to you. So how you're treated when you're, if you're coming off of drugs in a county jail, is very dependent on what jail you happen to be in.
What county you're in.
Yeah.
So there aren't universal rules on treating withdrawal symptoms. It sounds, in fact, like there aren't, like there are actually a lot of differences in general, you know, in the practices that occur between prisons. I sort of expected things to be more standard. Was that a surprise to you in this reporting?
I was kind of surprised that not more jails had this option of, you know, giving people like methadone things like that. There, most of the jails have policies where they would help you with your withdrawals, but it's things like prenatal vitamins that they're giving inmates, or like electrolyte rehydration. So like Gatorade is considered a medication to deal with withdrawals. And we've seen people die in jails in Utah from withdrawals. And so you kind of look at, that was surprising to me to see that this is how it's being treated, is with, you know, Benadryl or painkillers and not other methods that usually work better.
Well, actually, let me bring Holly Richardson on this for a second. You know, Holly, people are sent to jail or to prison to be deprived of their freedom as a punishment, but we don't expect that to mean that they will also be deprived of their humanity or of their life. But that's what happened to these 71 people and maybe more. I don't know. What do you make of the fact that this is happening in our jails?
Well, I think, first of all, I think these types of reports are what make legislative change. I think Jessica's point about the differences in how you treat drug withdrawal, I think that may be something that state legislators are pretty interested in. I mean, one of the big issues that some legislators at least focus on are the opioid epidemic, right? And how do you treat that? And I went to a symposium recently where they were saying, we want to treat the people who are addicted as people who are sick and have a disease of addiction, right? Rather than these are bad guys and we need, you know, jail is the best answer for them because they're using and misusing these sometimes prescription medications, sometimes street drugs. But I think that legislative change might come out of a report like this. And then I think transparency is always better, right? And I think it would be healthy to break down and say, well, where are the deaths occurring? Because if there's a pattern, I think it's important to know that, right?
What do lawmakers actually, this is Jessica, back to you. What do lawmakers, that is, plan on doing with this data? I mean, they get it, they have this report, and now what kind of action might they take?
I think this was kind of just like the first step. Like, let's wrap our arms around this issue and see what's actually going on. So this was discussed at an interim committee meeting this week, which is why I did the story. And there was discussion of not like, let's make a statewide mandate, but like maybe county by county, the sheriffs, the people who are running these jails, will look at this data and find a better way to do things. So right now, I haven't heard of any like legislation or big statewide effort to change or like unify some of these policies.
Legislative session in January. Dan Harry.
Yeah, one of the problems I think, as I've edited some of the stories that we've been writing over the last year or so, is that The Sheriff's Association is in charge of putting out standards for the jails, and then they're in charge of inspecting the jails to see if they comply with the standards. And none of that information is public. They have released guidelines about what jails should be doing, but the specific standards that they're reviewing and checking for, they don't, and they don't release the results of these inspections. They've been very resistant to transparency, and as Jessica said, I think this is a first step, and the fact that this doesn't break it down by county, I think, again, is part of the resistance you're seeing from the establishment that for so long has just said, this is our domain, stay out.
Why that resistance, though? I mean, is it because simply, is there a fear that the light that would be shed would show too much?
Well, they make a couple of arguments. One is that it could jeopardize security if it got out how the jails were trying to ensure inmate safety. And the other is they're afraid of lawsuits. What they really don't want is they don't want the ACLU in there, accompanying them during inspections and second-guessing them.
The news on this is what's new, what happened this week, but I would urge listeners also to check out some of the archived reporting on this topic. Jessica Miller, we're talking about numbers, but you have in the past reported on some of the individual stories behind those numbers, the deaths, or the Tribune has. It's worth checking out at sltrib.com. I want to turn to another piece of reporting of yours, Jessica, from this week before we run out of time, actually. It's a story that a woman who reported being sexually assaulted was later charged for a crime herself, and it's tied to her claim of having been sexually assaulted. So how did this woman go from making that accusation to being charged with a crime? And maybe you could start with her initial report to police.
Yeah, so this is – it's kind of a complicated situation, but she reported couple of years ago that she was sexually assaulted by an acquaintance, and not to get into too much of the details here, but basically there were some concerns with her report that there were some concerns with her report, and they decided not to charge the case. And so from there, a year goes by, and she is charged up here in Salt Lake County with making a fraudulent claim against the Utah Office for Victims of Crime.
Her initial report was in St. George.
It was.
And then she gets charged here in Salt Lake County. Explain the charge that she was hit with.
Right. So it's a fraud charge. It's basically alleging that she defrauded the Office for Victims of Crime when she had submitted paperwork asking for her rape kit to be paid for. It's part of her report. She went to the hospital and had a sexual assault examination done. And so the allegation in the charge was that because she was asking for the rape kit to be paid and that there was misrepresentations about the crime, the sexual assault, that she was defrauding the crime victim's office by asking that be paid for. And that's pretty typical. I mean, that office pays for sexual assault kits for victims. So she wasn't doing anything unusual. She was just doing the paperwork to get her sexual assault kit paid for.
But somebody looked at her case, said, this doesn't hold up, and so we're going to charge her with fraud, essentially.
Yeah, and this, I mean, I would love to have the answers to how this even happened, because I tried figuring this out myself, talking with the prosecutors, like, why did you charge this case? And they said, well, the Department of Public Safety investigators brought it to us. Okay, you talk to them, and they say, well, this was a referral from the Utah Office for Victims of Crime. Okay, so then you go to them, and they say that these claims are private, so we can't tell you specifically, like, what it was. So it's kind of this mystery of, like, who in this chain of people thought that this was the proper way to handle the situation. Because there's cases all the time where prosecutors look at a case and don't file charges. That doesn't mean that a crime didn't happen or that she was making things up. I mean, who decided that this was fraud? I never was able to find out.
Am I right that her alleged attacker wasn't ever investigated himself or obviously not prosecuted? But
no, not really. I mean, they didn't even – when I called down to the prosecutors in Washington County because I was trying to figure out, like, did they ever consider charging her? They didn't even have a paper trail on the guy that she had accused. I mean, they never formally really, like, looked at this case very closely. Like, there was just a lot of – like, the story kind of changed as she was – talking with police, some of the evidence that you'd think would be there, like she'd said that she had bit him really hard and there were no bite marks. So the case was problematic, and it wasn't anything that the prosecutors like seriously looked at.
As far as the allegations of fraud against her went, I mean, that's a really unusual thing to have happen, correct? That's not something that we see very frequently.
No, yeah. I had never heard of this charge before. It's a charge specifically for defrauding this specific office. And so I had asked the courts to pull any other cases where this had happened before. And in the last like 5 years, there had only been two other times where anyone's ever faced this charge. And that was kind of a different situation where they said that they made up the crime. The cases were connected, that they admitted that this never happened, but they had claimed like $1,000 worth of damages with that office. So it was a different situation than what was happening here.
The fear from this woman's lawyer is that the charge itself, even though it has been, as you said, dismissed, is propping up a myth, the idea that there is a substantial amount of false sexual assault allegation going on out there. And that this plays into that. I mean, false reports are extremely rare, right?
Exactly. And I think her concern is that this could have a chilling effect on other victims, because the idea of like, I mean, there's already so many barriers. And then if you have the thought in your mind, like, well, if somebody doesn't believe me, if someone doesn't think this happened to me, I could get charged with a crime. And it's a misdemeanor, but it holds up to a year in jail. And she actually did spend time in jail for this because she had an arrest warrant issued for her after she didn't come to court, you know, 300 miles away from where she lives. And so she did, you know, spend time in jail for this and had that threat of jail. And so her attorney's concerned that this could have a chilling effect on other victims if they're worried that they're going to get charged with a crime for having a rape kit done.
It's such an odd story. I mean, it seems like there really wasn't much of a reason behind, as you pointed out, this fraud charge ever being brought against her, but it was brought against her nonetheless. Mm-hmm. Maybe Holly Richardson, I'll bring you in on this. I actually don't even know what to ask you. maybe for a comment on that potential chilling effect of this woman.
I agree, right? I mean, I think that's one of the conversations that I have had and heard is the backlash to a Me Too movement, right? So when people are willing to step forward and say, hey, this happened to me, and then you get a backlash like this, then you have fewer people who are willing to step forward. But you also have, I think on the other side, you have people who kind of beat their chest and say, see, I told you, you know, women are just out to get the guys. And that's one of the things that I have seen already that's been the most disappointing in kind of the whole conversation surrounding sexual assault and women, is that there's somehow this belief that the women or the victims, it doesn't really matter their gender, but that the victims have to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt before they even get out of the gate that something happened, right? I mean, why is the burden of proof on a victim in this situation? And not only was the burden of proof, but then there was pushback to the extent of even charging her with a crime. I think that's pretty outrageous.
Is this story kind of over now, Jessica? Is the victim herself seeking some sort of recommend? I mean, you said she spent time in jail. Mm-hmm. There's a lawyer who is, making statements on her behalf. What comes next?
Well, the charge was dismissed a couple of weeks ago. She had been facing it for about 9 months. And then the prosecutor went to court one day and asked for it to be dismissed. And now it is. So what she does from here, I'm not really sure. I mean, her attorney is a public defender. And so I don't know if there's anything that she can really do from this point. I mean, I think the contract kind of ends. Like, you're not facing a charge. So that's about it. So I'm not sure if there's any recourse here. I mean, this is, I guess, how the criminal justice system works. Like, you're faced with the crime and you had an arrest warrant out. They arrest. I mean, this is how the process works.
Right. And then, you know, charges are dismissed or not.
Right.
Check out the reporting that Jessica Miller did on this at sltrib.com. It's very worth it. We need to turn already for another break in the show. There's still more to come. When we come back, we'll actually turn to our underplayed stories of the week and then a feature on Salt Lake City's renewed Olympic hopes. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the local programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Holly Richardson, and Jessica Miller. It's our Friday morning news roundup. And to save time for a segment with Tribune sports reporter Chris Kamrani, we are going to turn already to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And Holly Richardson, let's begin with you if you're ready.
Sure. So there have been a lot of stories about Mayor and Major Brent Taylor and his unfortunate death in Afghanistan and his funerals this weekend. But I think one of the stories associated with that that could have gotten more press and maybe still will is the giant flag that's flying in Ogden Canyon. So it's a project done. It happens to be by my neighbor. His name's Kyle Fox. And he started this project on hanging the flag down by where we live. It's they call it Big Betsy. It's a quarter of an acre, weighs 400 pounds,
whoa,
right? It like this thing is gigantic. It takes a lot of manpower to get it up the canyon and hanging. But
is there enough wind to keep it upright?
They have it hung, and okay. I think that story is pretty awesome.
I got it. Fantastic. Thank you, Holly, for that. Jessica Miller, your pick for underplayed story of the week?
So I'm going to pick a story that maybe online this morning, or maybe I'm scooping myself and telling you about this, but over the summer, I did a profile on these young men who were trying to clear their father's name, that they had falsely accused him of sexual abuse when they were kids. The father went to prison for like 7 years for this crime. And now as adults, they're coming out and saying, like, we lied about this. How can we fix this? It's never happened. And so this week, the father filed a petition in court asking the judge to find him factually innocent. So this is just kind of like a new, renewed effort to clear his name, get him off the sex offender registry, and help him move forward with his life.
It's a pretty remarkable. I remember when the story came out. I've not seen it yet online, but check it out at sltrib.com. Dan, Harry, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
I don't know if they're underplayed, but I'll bring it up anyway, that the deaths of two pretty significant political figures in Utah. Mm-hmm. One is Jim Hansen, who served 22 years in Congress. He had been the Utah House Speaker before that and in local government. And Dan Jones, who was a very prominent pollster and educator, both kind of a different era when politics maybe was less toxic than it is now.
Hmm. Yeah. End of an era and the death of a couple of legends in Utah. I'm going to go with some reporting by Aaron Alberti and Peyton Harkins that this year has been one of the deadliest in terms of officer-involved shootings. This went along with their reporting on two shootings that took place last Friday. Those were the 13th and 14th people killed by police this year. Citing Salt Lake Tribune records dating back 15 years, their reporting shows that this year is equal to the deadliest 2 years. The use of deadly force, we want it to be a rare thing, something that only happens when necessary. But check out their reporting at sltrib.com. Dan Harry, Jessica Miller, Holly Richardson, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you very much for being here today.
Have a great weekend.
We're going to wrap up today with sports reporter Chris Kamrani and an update on Salt Lake City's renewed hopes for a second Winter Olympic Games. Chris, Salt Lake City wants to host the Winter Olympics once again and is hoping to secure a bid for an upcoming Olympics. Can you give us just like the overview of where we are in the decision-making process here? And what Salt Lake City is pinning its hopes on, because there are a couple of options, right?
Yeah. So earlier this week, Reno Tahoe dropped out, and it was before it was Salt Lake, Denver, Reno Tahoe as the three front runners that the USOC had asked to say, hey, are you guys interested? Everyone at the time said yes. Reno Tahoe came out earlier this week and said, financially, it just doesn't work for us. The way they projected their budgets would be they needed more than 7 years in order to have enough money. But the problem with LA 2028 is they kind of have a stranglehold on marketing and sponsorships because it's another domestic games.
I see. So the Los Angeles Olympics are going to interfere with Reno's potential money making.
Right. Yeah. When they kind of mapped out their budgets, they said they would need more. They would need just more time. They would need more time to make money, to plan for money in order to make it a fiscally responsible games. So they dropped out earlier this week, and now it's basically down to Salt Lake and Denver. And the USOC has said that they want to make a decision on who it's going to be by the end of the year.
Do either of them, you know, have an edge? I'm sure that each of them would say, yes, we have the edge. But
well, Salt Lake has the edge, I think, not only domestically but worldwide. You can go on Twitter or you can go find a bunch of articles of people who are Olympic experts who have covered games, who follow kind of the day-to-day monotony of what the IOC wants. And Salt Lake has such in-place infrastructure compared to anywhere else in North America. Maybe Lake Placid, but they're obviously not in the running. But you look at what Salt Lake has here, they have up-and-going venues that are used on an annual basis for World Cup and World Championship events.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think there was an audit last year that said there would be about $40 million necessary in terms of updating these venues from where they were 2002 to make them, you know, viable for 2030. But I mean, you have everything in place.
You answered a question that I was going to ask you, which is that, you know, what do we have to do in terms of venues to get up to snuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's $40 million. How much more would the state of Utah have to spend to host the Olympics?
The $40 million was part of an audit last year, and the state has started pumping that in to various venues this year. So they're getting everything up to speed. Like, I think the Olympic Oval in Kearns needed some work on the roof. And there's some other things. The bobsled track needed some stuff. But other than that, I think when it comes to how much it will cost, the projections that the Olympic Exploratory Committee said it would be about $1.29 billion, which is, in fact, cheaper than it was to put on the 2002 games.
Hmm. How much is it going to cost to make snow? That's another question.
No, that's I think a lot of people are legitimately concerned about that, not only in Salt Lake, but I think all over the Intermountain West is, you know, we've had a pretty barren winter the last few years,
yeah.
each and every winter. So it's like, I mean, 12 years from now, maybe things have changed. Maybe the weather patterns have changed. But it is definitely a concern, I think, for people who think, like, you know, how many snowmaking machines do we need to have on hand? Because even when I was in Pyeongchang, like, it didn't snow once while we were there. Oh. Everything was pretty much man-made.
Well, and a lot of water involved there as well.
Right.
This week we had members of the U.S. Olympic Committee visiting, Denver first and then
yep.
Salt Lake City. And,
yep.
and what were they doing? They were just checking out to see.
On-site visit is what they were calling it. It's kind of like a 12-hour crash course of, you know, officials here being able to woo and wow, say this is what we have going on. You know, they started early in the morning. They went to the Oval in Kearns. Then they went up to Park City at the Utah Olympic Park, saw the ski jump, saw the bobsled track, and they just made the rounds. And I think everybody here it's kind of a unique thing. I think everybody is on one page, official-wise. You know, you have the mayor, you have, you know, Senate President Wayne Niederhauser, you have a guy like Fraser Bullock, who was an integral part of the 2002 games, essentially not volunteering his time, but he is a big-time Olympic fan, and he always has been, and he was a key cog in keeping the Olympics here in 2002 after the scandals. So you have him involved, a guy who's been through the ringer, where, like, now this is easy compared to what they had to kind of clean up back in 2002.
Right.
So now it seems like everybody's on the same page, and I mean, the Tribune and the Hinckley Institute did a poll last year, and 83% of the people who took the poll said they were in favor of it.
Mm.
And I think there was another poll that said 89% would be in favor of it.
I mean, I remember way back when in, you know, 98 or whenever the bid process was going on, and we'll get to the scandals in a second, but there were some amount of people who were vocally opposed to Salt Lake City hosting the games. They were worried about things like impact on the environment, on our canyons, and you know, additional development
sure.
in general. Have we seen much of that kind of opposition now? Or
ironically, there was a press release that went out yesterday during the USOC's visit.
Yeah.
And there's a non-for-profit called Alliance for a Better Utah.
Sure.
And what their message is they want the leadership, the officials, just to do their due diligence as much as possible, just to go maybe the extra mile to make sure that, you know, this would be a positive for this state, the city and the state, when it comes to environmental impact. When it comes to, you know, civic impact, we know that there's traffic in Utah. We have thin streets in Salt Lake City, and the population is boomed compared to what it was 16 years ago. And then when you look 12 years down the road, the way the population is still booming, how is that going to affect the everyday Utahn, you know, going to and from work? Because as you know, the Olympics are not only a two-week thing, it is a several-year process, and once things get ramped up, they get ramped up legitimately.
Yeah, it's an interesting consideration, definitely. I'm going to circle back to something that we kind of touched on for a brief moment, but wooing and wowing the U.S. Olympic Committee. You know, any scholarships given out? No, I'm kidding. there was a period of time, though. I mean, you know, there is this background to Salt Lake City securing the Olympic bid back in 2002, a somewhat sordid history. I would imagine, and actually I would hope, might even be the right word, that everything is above board this time around. Chris, are officials trying to keep it squeaky clean so that there isn't even like a hint of...
Right, and they are. And the thing is, selfishly, from a journalistic standpoint, as you know, like when they allow you to come to so many things and use things on the record, I think that means that they're being as transparent as possible. Like, they didn't need to invite a bunch of media to the luncheon yesterday at Rice-Eccles Stadium, but there was quite a few media members there, whether print, radio, or TV, trying to talk to people about what's going on.
Yeah.
It's like an unwritten rule, I think, in the wake of 2002. It's like, let's be transparent as possible. Let's let people in on what we're trying to do. And it makes total sense. You know, people will always remember the scandal, but I think what this group has going for them now is that a lot of people still consider the 02 games one of the best winter games ever. And a lot of that goes into it was right after 9/11. Right. The country was looking for a rallying point, and Salt Lake and Utah and the Olympic athletes were able to deliver when they needed them the most. But, you know, even going around the world, whether it was in Rio or in South Korea, a lot of international journalists I talked to even said, like, that was one of their favorite games ever. Wow. And a lot of them mentioned what Salt Lake is selling to the USOC is proximity of everything. You can get off the airplane and be in Park City within 45 minutes. If there's an event in Ogden, same thing. If there's an event in Provo, same thing. Whereas, like,
Denver,
not so much. Even in Pyeongchang, I mean, you land in Seoul, it took us an hour and a half to get on the train to go across the country to Pyeongchang, and then even then, you're in a bus for 45 minutes from Pyeongchang up into the mountains. Whereas, I just don't think when it comes to kind of the schematics of what's perfect in an ideal world, especially for winter games where you have so many things stretched out, Salt Lake just has an edge over anybody.
Hmm. When are we going to know who the U.S. Olympic Committee picks for 2026 and for 2030, for that matter? That's for the U.S. bid cities. And
right.
then when will each of those cities know whether they've been selected by the International Olympic Committee?
So the 2026 thing is an interesting wrinkle. I think a lot of people are kind of waiting for the IOC to approach the USOC because of all this bid cities that they have that are kind of floundering. Calgary voted vehemently no earlier this week.
Yeah.
So now there's only basically two bid cities left, and it's Milan, Italy, and Stockholm, Sweden. You know, I mean, Italy hosted Torino,
right,
and Stockholm is a winter place. But it's like, and you read some reports, a couple of these places are still on shaky ground. So I think a lot of people in the Olympic community are waiting for the IOC to approach the USOC and say, hey, could Salt Lake potentially be an emergency pick for 2026? The officials here are being very, very, you know, cautious because they don't want to steal the thunder of LA 2028, understandably so. But in terms of 2030, they're supposed to pick by the end of the year. The USOC is supposed to pick between Salt Lake and Denver. And then when we find out who the IOC wants for 2026, that's scheduled to be next September in Italy.
Okay. Any other sort of additions to this story that we're missing?
No, I think the 2026 thing is definitely something to keep track of. It would be an expedited process to think that, you know, Salt Lake or whoever the IOC would approach potentially the USOC and say, hey, could we maybe throw these guys in the mix? That would be an expedited process that you really haven't seen before. But the way you're seeing potential bid cities dropping like flies when it comes to 2026, it makes it very tough. I think if LA 2028, if 2028 was somewhere else, I think Salt Lake would be 2026, hands down.
But they tend to want to spread it out.
They want to spread it out. And a big part of this comes down to marketing and sponsorships and how much money you can raise, revenue.
Yeah.
It's huge because everybody wants to either break even, fingers crossed, or make it a viable, financially responsible games. You want to be able to make money. You don't want to go under, whereas you've seen so many places in recent years. I mean, you go to Sochi, you go to Rio. Like, these places are just barren.
I was going to say, Chris, are the Olympics a burden or a boon for the communities?
This is a conversation going on in that community throughout the world. You know, Nancy Armour at the USA Today wrote a really interesting column yesterday about, like, who wants the Olympics anymore and why would you? Mm-hmm. And on one hand, it's like, yeah, like, how many people want to spend billions of dollars for something that's there for 2 weeks and leaves? But on the flip side of the coin is, like, you look at a place like Salt Lake, whereas it was here in 2002, and it really hasn't ever left. I mean, we still have speed skaters and skiers who are based here. You have World Cup and World Championship events here every year. I'm up on the mountain freezing to death, so trust me, I know. But they draw on this cliche of legacy, and I think Utah is just a really rare place, and I think Utahns like to showcase what they have to offer, and I think 2002 was just a really rare opportunity that they capitalized on. And, I mean, if we're to trust these polls, it seems like people would be really interested in doing it again.
All right, some Utah hospitality possibly on display once again. Chris Kamrani, Salt Lake Tribune sports reporter, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris Kamrani bringing us up to speed on Salt Lake City's renewed Olympic ambitions to end this edition of Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Next week, this show will be taking a break for the Thanksgiving holiday. It is the 1 week a year that we don't produce this show, but we will be back here the following Friday, so tune in. Coming up next here on KCPW, it's the final interview with the veteran American politician and former Senator Joe Tidings and his vivid memories of working with the Kennedy dynasty, as well as his unhappy relationship with Donald Trump, featuring cameos by Truman, Stalin, and Churchill. That's just ahead on KCPW Presents. Check it out. This show is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune and is heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. Many thanks to everyone who helps make this show possible, including Jesse Ellis, the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan, and our producer, Emily Means. You can find podcasts at kcpw.org or through your podcast app. Should you be interested, you can always catch up with KCPW on Facebook at kcpw88.3 or on Twitter, where we are at kcpw. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a great weekend and a great holiday next week.